Good afternoon and welcome to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee, the Senate's Committee on the Economy. Today is February 8th, 2018, and the time is 1:33. With me this afternoon is Senator Stevens. Welcome.
Thank you.
Senator Machicki, welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair.
Senator Gardner, welcome.
Thank you.
And Vice Chair Senator Myers, welcome.
Thank you.
And I also want to thank Carrie, the recording secretary. Really appreciate you being here, and also the LIO operator, Ben. We do have a full agenda today. Wanted to mention to those listening online and here in person for the agenda, we will start with a bill previously heard, which we actually didn't get to. This is Senate Bill 105. Introduced by Senator Wilson. It's the Marital and Family Therapy License and Services. We have one amendment, and the intention for this bill today is to pass it out of committee. We'll have public testimony. Following Senate Bill 105, we will move on to Senate Bill 155, Real Estate Appraisal Management Companies, followed by Senate Bill 116, the Education Tax Credit Bill, followed by House Bill 126, Organized Militia and Workers' Compensation, introduced by Representative Tuck, and then SJR 12, related to net neutrality, introduced by Senator Wilikowski. So welcome to the committee again. I know we have several of your bills that were before us, but Senator Wilson, please feel free to introduce the bill to us, and you have with you Gary Zepp, who's also before the committee. Thank you, Gary. We'll have the bill introduced, take committee questions, open it for public testimony, and then look to the will of the committee.
So. Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Senator David Wilson, Senate District D, Wasilla, Big Lake, Meadow Lakes, Point Mac area. And with me today is one of my legislative staff, Mr. Gary Zepp. Before you today, Senate Bill 105, Marital and Family Therapy License and Services, Version D. And this, if enacted, Senate Bill 105 would add licensed marital family therapists to the state's independent licensed practitioners in order to address the shortage of Medicaid-eligible behavioral health providers in the state, afford more options for beneficiaries, and to increase access for care. Currently, the licensed marital and family therapists, otherwise known as MFTs, are the only allowed to provide services in community health clinics and physician mental health clinics, which effectively limits numbers of willing providers in the mental health care arena. 105 expands the medical assistance for reimbursement services to cover services specifically in the Senate bill. This also designates your licensed marriage family therapists as providers eligible under to render Medicaid funded services to independent practitioners under Alaska State Statute 47.07.030, subsection B. It clarifies supervisory requirements for the marriage family therapist licenses and requires them to carry licenses and liability insurance for the regulatory investigation fees of at least $30,000. In 2016, the Board of Marital Family Therapy unanimously recommended the statute change in the contained in Senate Bill 105. And for the record, this really came to us as part of the department and through the board is our understanding that this was done in Senate Bill 74. As I was on the legislature this time and research, these recommendations were discussed, considered during the passage of 74, but ultimately didn't make their way in the final version of the bill. The department has already done the regulations for this bill, but before they enact the regulations, they would like this legislative language and statute before they enact this. So, meanwhile, as I mentioned, the board itself has requested these changes in statute to help increase the access to behavioral health services. And with that, I'll turn this over to Mr. Zepp to go over the sectional and the physical notes.
Thank you, Senator Wilson.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Gary Zepp, Senator Wilson's office. We have two fiscal notes relating to Senate Bill 105, one from the Department of Commerce, Community and Economic Development, and the second from the Department of Health and Social Services. The Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development's fiscal note is dated 2/2/18. The appropriation allocation is corporations, business, and professional licensing, OMB component number 2360. The fiscal note total is $1,300 for the services line in FY19, with no expenditures in the outlying years reflected on the fiscal note. The revenue collection supporting the expenditures are receipt-supported services, and total $1,300 for FY19, with no revenues in the outlying years reflected on the fiscal note. The summary of the analysis states the funding is needed for regulation review, advertising, printing, and postage. The second fiscal note that we've received is from the Department of Health and Social Services, stated 2/3/18. The appropriation is Medicaid services. The allocation is Behavioral Health Medicaid Services, OMB component 2660. The fiscal note total is $50,000 for the services line in FY19 and $1,800,000 in the grants line for FY2020 and beyond. The revenue supporting the fiscal note is a blend of federal receipts at 66% and GF match at 34%. The FY19 revenues show $25,000 of federal receipts and $25,000 of general fund match, totaling the $50,000. FY20 annually thereafter showed $660,500 of federal receipts and $340,300 of general fund match, totaling $1,800,000. And the summary of the analysis states FY19 for the $50,000 for development of business rules and the Medicaid management information system detailing the parameters for services and reimbursement. FY2020 and annually thereafter reflect the $1,800,000, and it's the average annual per recipient cost times the estimated number of recipients, the Medicaid increment requested. The department estimates $1,581 annually per recipient times 633 recipients at a total of $1,773. The sectional analysis for Senate Bill 105 impacts the subsections of AS 808.63, Marital and Family Therapists, and AS 47.07, Medical Assistance for Needy Persons. If you have the bill in front of you, page 2, and I'm going to cover the multiple lines because it kind of jumps around for Section 1 and the following sections. Lines 17, 19, 21, 23 through 25, and 28 through 31. This is Section 1 that amends AS 08.63.100A to provide that 1,500 hours of clinical contact with couples, individuals, and families that is required for licensure to practice marital and family therapy must be supervised. Clarifies that 1,500 hours of clinical contact must include at least 100 hours of individual supervision and 100 hours of group supervision. Provides that the required hours of individual and group supervision may be conducted by one or more supervisors. Requires that an applicant for a license to practice marital and family therapy must have a professional liability insurance, including coverage of at least $30,000 for the applicant's regulatory investigation fees. On page 3, lines 2 through 18, which are encompass section 2, provides the qualifications for a person to perform individual supervision of a licensee under AS 08.63 and the qualifications for a person to perform group supervision of a licensee under AS 08.63. And if we go to page 3, line 31, section 3 adds marital and family therapy services to the optional services that the Department of Health and Social Services may provide medical assistance for under AS 47.07.030. If we move to page 4, lines 4 through 16, there's a new subsection G, and it defines direct supervision, mental health psychiatrist, and psychiatrist for AS 47.07.030. On page 4, lines 17 through 31, it's a new section H, and it provides that the department may reimburse a mental health physician clinic for certain services if the services are provided by a psychiatrist or an individual who works under the direct supervision of a psychiatrist and is licensed to practice as a professional counselor, a marital and family therapist, a physician assistant, an adult or family psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner, a psychologist, a psychological associate, or a clinical social worker. And moving on to page 5, lines 2 through 3, section 6 authorizes the department and the Board of Marital and Family Therapy to adopt regulations necessary to implement this act. Also on page 5, line 8 is section 7, which provides an immediate effective date for section 6 of this act. And lastly, page 5, line 9, provides a January 1st, 2018 effective date for sections 1 through 5 of this act. And that summarizes the fiscal notes and the sectional analysis.
Thank you, Gary. Before we get too far into this, he just mentioned that the effective date is in 2018. And so, members, we do have a friendly amendment before you. I was hoping we could actually amend the bill so that it gets out in the correct form and we're not in some sort of time warp situation. But so the bill or the amendment basically changes the effective date to be 2019, the year that you see on page 5, line 9. Senator Meyer, would you like to move the amendment?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I move consensual amendment number 1, which is to, on page 5, line 9,
Delete 2018 and insert 2019.
Thank you. Is there any objection to moving the amendment, which is actually prepared by Ledge Legal? Senator Gardner?
Thank you. Just a quick question. Reading the fiscal note about this, it says this, let's see, it's which fiscal note is it? Sorry, I've got mine in a, it's one that has a, narrative that's the full page. And the second paragraph talks about the associated regulations contemplated by legislation are to be adopted by July 1, 2018. Does our amendment address that concern? One is the effective date, and the other is the date should be set back beyond the effective date of the bill. Is that something we need to address, or is it covered?
Senator Gardner, so you're speaking about OMB component number 2660. Is that something a sponsor or your staff can answer? We'll go ahead and take a brief at ease. Senate Labor and Commerce Committee is called back to order, and we've all phoned our friends, and we all now know that the fiscal note is updated to reflect the legislation. So there should be no problem, Senator Gardner, with that, but thank you for the question. Are there other questions from committee members?
Madam Chair.
Senator Machicki.
Is it on the amendment, or have we already accepted?
We have not passed the amendment.
I withdraw my objection.
Is there any further objection to amendment number 1? Okay, seeing none, amendment number 1 passes. Senator Machicki?
I will have questions about the UGF and the fiscal note, but I will see this again in finance, Madam Chair, so I won't take up your time today.
Okay, thank you. We also do have the director of the Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing here in the room, Janie McCullough, and Dorothy Aguirre with the Board of Marital and Family Therapy. Are there any questions for those members? Senator Gardner?
I have a question for the sponsor, and just to make sure I understand what the anticipated impact of this is. So LMFTs can currently practice sort of under the direct supervision, and that allows them to bill Medicaid through their sponsor, if that's the right term. And this with this bill, they can go independent and be able to bill Medicaid as an independent provider if they choose to do that?
Through the chair, Senator Gardner, this bill has the two components. One is to understand and try to clarify the definitions of supervisory. Some clinics and some entities may have more than one psychiatrist or one more supervisor come in. They may have Dr. A come in on 1 month, Dr. B come in the other month, just to have that one person looking for supervised hours to be concurrent so they can see Dr. A and Dr. B can supervise that same person as that contracted would allow. This right now, they currently cannot bill for Medicaid services under statute, so this will allow them, even with the supervision as some of the clinics, or if it's a private entity, they could also be able to bill on their own as well.
Madam Chair, if I may.
Senator Gardner.
Then I'm a little bit confused about the comment on the three-page fiscal note that says we're unsure the number who will be interested in beginning to independently bill Medicaid, subjecting their practices to the documentation and audit requirements. So with 100 in the state with an active license, I'm just trying to sort of try to figure out or anticipate the beneficial impact of, I'm not questioning that it's beneficial, but just how much demand there is for this ability to bill independently. Because it also comes with a headache. It's like doing tax returns.
And that's up to those, through the chair, Senator Gardner, that's up to the independent practice of those licensed mental health family therapists. This is more intended for a lot of the nonprofit agencies that are able, or grantees through the state of Alaska, who were sort of given this promise of if you build it, they'll come mentality for a lot of the Medicaid expansion. That did not occur in a lot of entities, and they were not able to benefit from the expansion through this. And if the chair, we can also give out a sort of our legislative memo of the of alleged research and understanding a little bit more upon that. While substance abuse grants have expanded and they saw the benefit in those providers, mental health clinics did not see that expansion growth for the chronically mental ill or for children services. So even though that they're eligible, they did not come for services for those things. So this is also to increase the demand, for the capacity to help meet the demand that's out there. If you call around now asking for a full integrated substance abuse assessment with behavioral health integrated, you're looking at about a 3-week average window to get into for behavioral health services in that sense. So this is just trying to meet the demand that the state has already have to help increase some of our behavioral health and substance abuse services in the state.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I just have two questions for the sponsor. The first is related to telemedicine. Does this bill have anything to do with telemedicine, or can it be provided through telemedicine?
I will leave that for, I think Mr. McCarthy may be on the phone to answer that through that. I'm not sure upon the regulations of that through Medicaid billable services.
Okay, Mr. McCarthy's not online.
Okay.
My next question is there any opposition that you are aware of to this legislation?
Not at this time.
Okay. Any other questions of committee members? I'll go ahead and look for my answer at some other point. I won't hold the bill for that reason. I'll go ahead and open public testimony for Senate Bill 105 related to marital and family therapy licensure and services. Is there anybody here in Juneau who wishes to testify on the bill? Okay, is there anyone online who wishes to testify? Okay, seeing none, public testimony on Senate Bill 105 is closed. Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I move that we move from committee Senate Bill 105 as amended with attached fiscal notes and attached recommendations.
Is there any objection to moving the bill? Okay, seeing none, so moved. Thank you, Senator Wilson, and we will take a brief at ease. Senate Labor and Commerce Committee is called back to order. Next, we have Senate Bill 155, introduced by Vice Chair Senator Meyer, related to real estate appraisal management companies. Senator Meyer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I'm going to just give some brief opening remarks and then turn it over to my trusty staff, Edward Mortledge. Madam Chair, thank you for hearing Senate Bill 155. Senate Bill 155 was brought to my attention that due to the Dodd-Frank Act in 2010, there's federal deadline looming for states to put into place comprehensive regulations regarding appraisal management companies, and that deadline is August of this year. That's why it's important that we take this bill up this year. And for those who don't know, appraisal management companies are business entities that administer networks of independent appraisers to fulfill real estate appraisal assignments on behalf of lenders. And these companies will no longer be allowed to perform residential appraisals in the state of Alaska after August 20th, 2018, without the passage of a bill similar to this one, Senate Bill 155. And this could cause some problems for realtors, bankers, and have an adverse impact on our economy. Alaska is only one of four states that's left, plus Washington, D.C., that have not yet passed this comprehensive legislation. The other three states are Massachusetts, New York, and Ohio, and all three of them are also in the process of passing legislation. So this may be a little bit of a surprise to people because I generally am not a fan of increased government regulation, but I believe this bill will promote public trust and consumer protection and establish the oversight enforcement where there is none today. So, Madam Chair, with those remarks, I'd like to turn the floor over to my staff to give a more comprehensive review and perhaps go through the sectional analysis if you'd like.
Thank you, and welcome, Edra.
Thank you. For the record, Edra Mortledge, staff to the sponsor, Senator Meyer. As he mentioned, he did a good overview of the bill. Just for a little bit more background, as he also mentioned, following the implementation of the Dodd-Frank Act in 2010, states who choose to regulate appraisal management companies have to have these comprehensive state laws in place by August 2018. However, I did want to just briefly call your attention to a letter that you should have on your desks. This just came to my attention right before this meeting, that the department has requested a one-year delay in the state implementing their AMC program. So if that's granted, the state would have until August of 2019 versus this year. So in addition to the federal government requiring that these comprehensive laws are in place to assess a registry fee and remit that to the federal government, they established minimum standards for these companies, these appraisal management companies, and those are also contained in this bill. And I believe we have the department here who can probably give you a better explanation of what those standards are and penalties for not complying with the standards. We also have some other experts here, some subject matter experts that can answer more detailed questions about how these companies operate in the state of Alaska. But if you'd like, I can go through a sectional analysis of the bill.
Would you? Thank you, Edra.
Sure. So Section 1 adds a new subsection J to allow the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development to establish a fee for regulatory costs and a mechanism for reporting those fees. Section 2 requires the department to establish a registry fee as required by the federal government and permits the department to remit those fees to the federal government. Section 3 amends the powers and duties of the Board of Certified Real Estate Appraisers to require regulations for appraisal management companies. Section 4 authorizes the board to examine records of appraisal management companies, requires those companies to submit information to the board, and allows investigations of alleged violations. Sections 5 and 6 add a new section to the statutes regarding appraisal management companies, including provisions for registration, reporting records retention, and inspection requirements, exemptions, prohibited practices, and disciplinary proceedings. Section 7 are definitions, including appraisal management services, appraisal panel, company, controlling person, and principal dwelling. Section 8 allows for fingerprinting of a controlling person of an appraisal management company through the Department of Public Safety. Section 9 allows real estate appraisal management companies that the registry fees be included in the definition of program receipts and non-general fund program receipts. And Section 10 is an applicability clause, just stating that this act applies to a person offering or providing appraisal management services on or after the effective date of the act. There is also a fiscal note from the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development, and I believe somebody from the department is here to go over that.
Senator Stevens.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question on a letter that you had spoken of earlier. A little confused. It was just February 8th. It was from Sarah Chambers, Deputy Director of the Department of Community of Commerce. It was to James R. Park, Executive Director of what? I'm not sure. And I guess the question is, do we know if it's going to be extended? Do we have any idea if that's going to happen?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, this literally just came into my inbox.
Oh, that's right. You just saw it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so I think probably somebody from the department would be able to answer that.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Sarah. Do you mind coming forward, please?
Good morning, or afternoon, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sarah Chambers. I'm the Deputy Director of the Division of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing.
And so the question was related to the letter that we just received prior to the hearing regarding the extension that the state is asking for until August 10th, 2019. I think Senator Stevens was wondering if we're hopeful that this is going to go through or what your prognosis is for this, for getting what we're asking for.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Through the chair, Senator Stevens, yes, I did just send this off this morning. We have been working with the chairman of the Board of Certified Real Estate Appraisers here in the state to ensure that all parties were working together to recognize that this extension was possible and that we would have the board's blessing in going ahead and requesting the extension. Per the memo issued by the Appraisal Subcommittee, which is the oversight body for federal real estate appraisal transactions, the state does meet the threshold for receiving an extension, but because we just initiated that conversation, we haven't received confirmation.
Ms. Chambers, if the bill passes, is the extension needed?
Madam Chairman, thank you. The extension is needed because the regulations that would be required for the board to adopt, plus the fee regulations if the department is given fee authority in the bill, then we would need to have time to promulgate those regulations to have in place by the time of the effective date, which would not be possible by this August.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sarah, the question I would have is, why didn't you bring this bill forward or the governor's office, knowing that this deadline was fast approaching?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, I don't really know the answer to that question. Typically, boards identify their own needs and seek their own legislation, and when the board asks for assistance or when they let us know of a looming deadline, then we come alongside, and perhaps that communication didn't happen before recently. So I'd be happy to follow up with you on specifically what the dynamics were, but from my estimation in reviewing the bill is that the board moved forward and didn't request assistance from the division, which is pretty typical and healthy.
Madam Chair, I don't know if that's healthy because all the other states except four have passed this, and we're one of the last ones, and this is a very this is very important as far as lending goes and the real estate business goes. So this is something that we probably should have done a long time ago, in my opinion. But since you're here, I do have a question. How much activity do you anticipate this taking you? Because I see you've added a new person, and of course it'll be receipts paid for, which is good from a state standpoint. It won't cost the state any more money. But do we really need a full-time person to administer this?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, thank you. Regarding the first part of the question regarding the timeliness, I'm hoping that the chairman of the board is Mr. Derry is online and might be able to speak to the board's deliberative process. Regarding the second part, we do not anticipate needing a full-time examiner, but we're unable to request half a person through a fiscal note. So we're requesting the time that we need and would bill any other additional expenses for work that examiner might do outside of this program to any other receipt-supported program that they might work on. So it's really a technicality with how we are able to request staff through a fiscal note. There's no way to hire someone part-time, so we have to ask for a full position. However, I can guarantee you there's no shortage of work in our office.
Okay, very good, Madam Chair. And I'm not going to quibble over the fiscal note. That's we'll let the finance department do that. But it does appear like there's $80,000 in there for personal services, which has got to be pretty close to a full-time person. Okay, that's all the questions I have.
Thank you. Any further questions? Okay, seeing none, I'll go ahead and open public testimony for Senate Bill 155. And David Derry is online. David, if you could answer any questions that came up during your testimony, that would be wonderful. And we'll go ahead and invite you to testify first.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate the opportunity to address the legislature regarding this bill. I guess, first of all, I would state that the appraisal board does support the bill, and we are ready to assume oversight of AMCs, appraisal management companies, as outlined in the bill. As a response to the timeline here of why we're close to the drop-dead date of 2018 on this bill, I would just offer that the Alaska chapter of the Appraisal Institute had proposed a very similar AMC bill in 2014, and I was not on the board at the time, but I'm a member of the Alaska chapter of the Appraisal Institute, and the chapter was unable to get any support in the legislature to actually introduce the bill. And I think that the appraisal chapter then sort of lost interest in that. We're a bit frustrated about the fact that they couldn't get the support, and so it sort of died. And since I've been on the board, which is since 2016, I guess I got on the appraisal board, this has been something that's been on our agenda to work towards. We've actually, within our appraisal board, set up sort of a little task force to formulate revisions to the bill that the Alaska chapter of the Appraisal Institute had done, and work towards getting this introduced. So it was definitely on the top of our agenda to work towards, and I think that Senator Meyer's efforts here and also Representative Josephson in the House are greatly appreciated in getting this introduced. We support it. And just a couple of things here, I guess, regarding the extension to 2019, that's something that I just became aware of actually myself, and that's something that was just actually issued recently. It's not something that we've known about for much time, but it's important, I think, to recognize that the opportunity to get that extension to 2019 is something that we'll probably will need. It really takes the pressure off as far as doing the regulations necessary when and if the bill is enacted. But I think it's important that we have this legislation in process that shows that we're working towards that, and hopefully that would be granted. The ASC, the Appraisal Subcommittee that letter came from, is actually the federal regulatory oversight entity that we as the appraisal board are audited by, and that would be the same entity that would also be doing oversight of appraisal management companies as part of their periodic audits of our board. Just a couple of things I would offer here regarding the bill. just a couple of changes in the section of the bill, which is actually on page 5, line 21. It states that the surety bond of not more than $25,000 as required by the board. We're recommending, as a board, we're recommending a surety bond of $150,000 instead of the $25,000. And our reason for that is that basically we think that the $25,000 is an inadequate amount of bonding. If an AMC is operating in the state and as part of their function, they would be essentially contracting with a variety of appraisers, and the appraisers would be working for the appraisal management company, do their work, and then in turn would be billing the AMC for their fees. $25,000 is a pretty modest amount when you think of the cost of doing appraisal reports, particularly in rural areas where you're having to add airfare and transportation. So $150,000 we think is a reasonable amount and probably not a costly amount for an AMC to actually secure a bond from an insurance company. Some states, in enacting AMC legislation regarding this bonding provision, have included in there establishing the bond at 150% or not less than 150% of the AMC's annual billings over the previous 12 months. And we just think getting involved in trying to figure out and verify, you know, billings and calculating percentages is just, you know, something that's not necessary. So setting a simple dollar amount is the best way to go. The second item is the fingerprinting requirement that is actually on page 6, lines 4 through 9. We've actually received a determination, again, from the appraisal subcommittee that our process of background checks that we're using for appraisers is adequate without going through fingerprinting and background checks, and that would carry over then to the AMC, so it would be something that is not necessary. So with that, I will close my comments. I'm certainly available for any questions that I can answer.
Senator Gardner.
Thank you. On the issue of fingerprinting not being necessary, it's not required to comply with the Dodd-Frank's Act, or is it, I mean, I just don't know how it got in here if it's not required.
through the chair, this whole Dodd-Frank issue regarding appraisers and AMCs has been a long evolution process, even though the bill went into effect, as you see, in 2010. Things are still evolving as far as clarifying, and fingerprinting was something that got in there, and as the process has gone along, there was then a determination on a state-by-state basis that fingerprinting wasn't necessary for appraisers. It was not a requirement under Dodd-Frank. And our process that we're using for our appraiser qualification is satisfactory without that. So it was in there because it was originally part of the requirements, but then subsequently was not needed, determined that you didn't have to have that. Some states are still doing that, and some states have opted to continue to do fingerprinting, but we didn't feel we wanted to include that requirement.
Senator Gardner.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And I have another question, too. Are real estate appraisers currently required to have background checks done?
Through the chair, no, they are not. That was another issue. Fingerprinting and background checks are both items that were hand in hand as far as this determination. And the process that we are using and had established in our application process for new certified appraisers was adequate to meet the requirement without actually doing a background check.
Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other questions for David Derry? Senator Meyer.
Thank you. And thank you for your testimony. So the criminal history record check and the fingerprinting, that is not required under the Dodd-Frank Act, or is that just not required in the state of Alaska?
It's not required under Dodd-Frank, a determination by the appraisal subcommittee or ASC determined that it was not required to have fingerprinting and background checks. You're right. So.
Okay. And, Madam Chair, I know we have some other folks that are much more familiar with this act than I am, but the surety bond of $25,000, do you have any idea what other states require? I know you're offering $150,000.
Yes, through the chair, I do not have a breakdown by state. Like I was testifying there, I do know what states, some states are using, as I stated, 150%, but as far as the fixed bond amounts, I do not.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, David. Next, I'm going to go to Greg Deal, who's online with Wells Fargo Bank, and then I'll come back to the room and ask William Scogan to come forward and be ready once Mr. Deal has completed his testimony. Mr. Deal, if you could provide your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Again, it's Greg Deal, Regional President for Wells Fargo Bank, Alaska. And thank you for the opportunity to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 155. First of all, I'll start by saying that Wells Fargo supports Alaska Senate Bill 155. As mentioned earlier by Senator Myers, you know, if the state doesn't set up a regulatory system for AMCs by August of 2018 or amended to 2019, then homelenders like Wells Fargo cannot use AMCs for federally regulated transactions. Those loans include those loans sold to government-sponsored enterprises such as Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which make up the majority of loans, mortgage loans in Alaska. Wells Fargo and our customers are simply customers of the appraisal management companies. However, we do find great value in their services, as AMCs ensure there's no direct contract between a loan officer and an appraiser. This helps to eliminate any potential or perceived conflicts of interest and ensures an independence of the valuation process. By doing this also, it also helps our customers ensure that they're getting an accurate value on their home. Wells Fargo uses the services of appraisal management companies for all our appraisals on all our mortgage and home loans in Alaska, and for that matter, across our footprint. You know, Wells Fargo and most other home lenders will no longer be able to use the valuable services of the AMCs if Senate Bill 155 is not enacted. Ultimately, we feel this bill is good for both homeowners and mortgage loan lenders in Alaska, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Actually, I can ask you.
Senator Michicki.
Thank you. So, just to clarify, this is only the requirement is only for federally related transactions. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Which is can you guesstimate the proportion of the loans that you issue?
Well, I reached out there for our Wells Fargo Home Mortgage area here in Alaska, and it was 90. We had 10 loans out of 1,471 that would not have been followed under the GSE rule.
Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else online who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 155? Is there anyone in the room who wishes to testify? Welcome, Mr. Scogan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Bill Scogan. I'm with the firm of Troutman Sanders and represent REVA, which is the National Trade Association of Appraisal Management Companies, Real Estate Valuation Advocacy Association. That's a mouthful, so we usually say REVA. We're obviously in strong support of this bill and have appreciated the good work of the legislative staff and the committee and our sponsors, and appreciate the good words from the board and from Wells Fargo and others in support of this bill. It's very important to all of us in the residential real estate industry, and we worked carefully in the other 46 states and the four remaining plus D.C. to try to get this done. And happy to stand for any questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Scogan? Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Scoggins, you heard the board president recommendation on a surety bond of $150,000 versus the $25,000 that we have in the bill. Is that kind of the standard statewide, or is that a little high, or how does that fit?
My memory fails me on exactly what the surety provisions are in all the other states, but $150,000 would be on the very high side of that, and we believe that the bill as you drafted is probably adequate. The important thing here, though, is the passage of the bill by this legislature prior to August 10th, and so that's what we're really focused on.
Okay, and Madam Chair, does the criminal background checks well, I guess the bill has fingerprinting and criminal background checks, but the recommendation was that that's not necessary. Is that your understanding as well?
Madam Chair, I ignored you earlier. Debate probably flows through the chair. That's up to if the licensing board in the state can satisfy the requirements of the federal appraisal subcommittee, and it's something less than that, we're comfortable with whatever is established.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, and thank you. Appreciate your patience in waiting to testify. Sure. Is there anyone else in the room who would like to testify on the bill? Okay, seeing none, public testimony for Senate Bill 155 is closed. It's the intention of the chair to move the bill. I feel that the surety bond issue can be addressed by the next committee in Senate Finance, and I personally am in favor of a higher level of safety, so I'm comfortable with the fingerprinting as it's written in the bill. Are there questions from committee members, comments?
Madam Chair.
Senator Michicki.
I had a question from Ms. Chambers, if that's possible.
Sarah, if you could join us back at the table.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm in support of the concept. My question is, I hate adding a position. We're working so hard to reduce positions wherever possible. Is there a way to manage this contractually without actually creating a new state position?
Again, for the record, this is Sarah Chambers with the division through the chair, Senator Michicki. That question is fairly complex and would be precedent setting and may find opposition by the employment unions. The protocols that we typically use are to request a position which is fully receipt supported and there's no UGF involved, and utilize that position to fulfill the mission set forth in the bill, and then put that person to work with many of the other licensing programs that we have. So the fiscal note, because our component level is at the division and not each board, the fiscal note pertains to the entire division. So this board would not see an increase of the $80,000 plus that's listed here. It would be a division authority increase. So this person could work part-time to fulfill the requirements of this bill and then be allocated to other programs. As committee members will likely hear, we have several board extensions going forward this year. One is the extension of the Board of Massage Therapists, and you are likely to hear testimony that we had twice the number of licensees than we expected through legislation and adoption of that board. So we have a need to continue to balance the resources with the services expected by Alaskans. So my hope would be that perhaps the other half of this person's time could go to assist that board, for example, in picking up the slack that we didn't know about when we first added that program in 2015.
Thank you.
Senator Michicki, I appreciate your line of questioning, and I know the private sector is oftentimes hires part-time, and perhaps as a member of finance you could look into what the hurdle is that prevents the department from asking for a part-time position. So thank you for the question. Senator Meyer?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I was going to say the same thing. I hope the Finance Committee will take a close look at this, because if this is only if the person's only half-time, then that's $80,000. So that means the person must be getting paid $160,000, which sounds like a lot. But again, I don't think that's something for us to dwell on here. We'll let Senator Michicki deal with it and Senator Stevens in Finance.
Senator Meyer?
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 155 from committee with attached fiscal notes and committee recommendations.
Is there objection to moving Senate Bill 155? Okay, seeing none, so moved. We'll take a brief at ease. Thank you. Good afternoon and welcome back to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee, the Senate's Committee on the Economy. Next, we have Senate Bill 116 related to education tax credits, and I'd like to personally welcome Senator Coghill and your aide, Chad Hutchinson, to present the bill, and then we'll take public testimony and answer questions in the normal drill. So, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, my name is John Coghill. Senate seat B is where I represent the Fairbanks North Pole area. Happen to have University of Alaska Fairbanks in my area, some mines, and so this has caught the attention of people in the interior. And with me is Chad Hutchinson, who will go through some of the detail. So I'll do a high-level opening statement, let him go through, and then be available for questions. Madam Chair, thank you for hearing this Senate Bill 116. It's a tax credit bill, which is probably a lightning rod title in many ways, but this deals with how to get industry and education working together in Alaska, which is sorely needed today in our time. So this will allow a variety of different tax methods to get some credit for investment in our education system. And there's a whole variety of them. They're everything from the the corporate tax to the fish tax. Mm-hmm. So it allows industries to partner in unique ways and specific ways to help our workforce develop. So what this bill does is it takes the expiration date of 2018 and moves it to 2025. It allows a further look at how that partnership works and what the benefits are. It also takes some of the credits that are narrowing down in 2021 and leaves them open until 2025. So that's why you'll see some complexity in changing the state law applications in the repealer section, which always causes some consternation for me whenever you see a whole list of repealers. You want to know what's going on. So that's the general gist of it. But it really comes to a time in our history where our education is needy. Our industry has needs to grow, but it wants to encourage local growth from our own people. That's true whether it's in our schools, K-12, in our university, in our research capacity. All those things are going to be very, very helpful. So this is a synergistic approach that I think is needed in the time and history in which we live and make every dollar work for the best we can in education in Alaska. And with that, Madam Chair, I can answer questions or we can go through the explanation that is a fairly straightforward PowerPoint that Chad Hutchinson has put together.
I think going through the PowerPoint would be great. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Chad Hutchinson. I work for Senator John Coghill. So we have SB 116 in front of us today. As Senator Coghill mentioned, it does two primary things, which is extends the sunset from 2018 to January 1st, 2025. It also ensures that the credits that exist today, which many are happy with, maintain until 2025. If left to its own devices and the sunset is passed, but they don't do anything about the credits, of their own accord, according to statute, they will narrow in scope and decrease in value in 2021. So we're trying to sync up the sunset date and broaden the tax credit out to 2025. So some of these slides we'll go through quickly. Most of the committee members are familiar with the education tax credit. It's, as Senator Coghill said, it's a program that private business has used to make direct contributions to education. If you want to look at the numbers specifically, generally there's a provision for up to 50% of the first contributions up to $100,000, $100,000 of the next $200,000, and 50% of the annual contributions beyond $300,000. So 100% of $200,000, 50% of beyond $300,000. The total amount upon which the total credit amount upon which a taxpayer can receive is $5 million for 1 year. And as Senator Coghill said, they are important because education benefits directly And if there is a direct need in the natural resource development community, for example, they can make direct contributions to that education resource in order to fill that need. The example that we think of most frequently is, and most recently, is the UAF engineering building. If there's a need for engineers, BP, Conoco, Usabelli, they all privately contributed to finish that building, and the result is that they can have more opportunities for future engineers, which can become Alaskan workers, which helps the workforce, which helps the mining community, and helps the state because they can increase the royalties at some point in time in the future, one would hope anyway. So a few examples of entities that can receive contribution is pretty broad. Most of it has, as you can see, has to deal with education. There's native cultural programs, apprenticeship programs, vocational training centers, a broad spectrum, all beneficial. The type of taxes that are affected, the corporate income tax, the fisheries industry is affected both with the fisheries business tax and the fishing resource landing tax. The insurance industry is affected. When you think about the insurance premium tax and the title insurance premium tax, both of those taxes, you can receive a credit based on contributions you make to an educational facility or program. And then one of the reasons why organizations such as the Council of Alaska Producers are supportive, you can get a credit on the mining license tax and the oil and gas production tax, which this body is very familiar with, and the oil and gas property tax. As far as the fiscal notes go, we've received one from the Department of Revenue. Good news, it's zero, and I believe the departments and the university and a few other online to answer any questions as it relates to that.
Zero.
Madam Chair, if I may, I can go through the sectional quickly to explain some of the more intricate procedures, if you'd like.
Do any members wish to hear the sectional, or are you comfortable with the bill?
I'd like to hear it. Thank you.
Please proceed through the sectional.
If I might, there's a lot of complexity in it, so what I asked him to do is do an overview first, and then if you need to go through every item, we can. But I think one of them, it'll show you what the repealers do in general, that I think that might answer most questions.
So, Madam Chair, going through the sectional. So sectional one, we decided it was important to have a legislative finding and intent because there's a lot of sections, figures, numbers in the bill itself. So we wanted to make sure it was clear that there was a synopsis to explain exactly what the bill does, which is, as I stated before, those two primary things, extending the sunset to 2025, January 1st, 2025, and ensuring that the credits that exist today continue until 2025, notifying everyone that if nothing is done, then they're expected to narrow and devalue in 2021. So Section 2 is basically the nuts and bolts. That is the effect on the taxes that I mentioned before. The taxes that exist today in statute are the ones that we're trying to carry forward. The sections that are repealed in the bill itself are actually the decreased value, and it's interesting. It's legislative drafting requires you to have, number one, the reduced tax amount, and then number two, the full tax amount that exists in statute today. And the reason why they do that is when in 2021, when it automatically switches over, if the legislature did nothing, then you have to have that secondary provisions to tell you exactly what the tax amount is going to be reduced to. So that's why you see the sectional expanding and explaining. At times you have to talk about a statute once and then twice, the exact same numbers, but it shows you exactly what would happen if there is that reduction that occurs in 2021 if there's no legislative action, essentially. So that's what Section 2 is. It's pretty extensive. Section 3 essentially repeals the narrowing of scope that's expected to occur in 2021. Section 4 extends the sunset from 2000. Oh.
Senator Gardner.
Thank you. Regarding the narrowing of scope, can you explain a little bit more what was supposed to drop out that under this provision will not?
Yes, Senator Gardner, through the chair. So in 2010, they changed the value of the tax credits. It went from an accumulative $1,500 as a maximum cap. They switched it to $5 million. They also, in 2011, and excuse me, yeah, 2011, 2014, they expand the broadness as far as what can be applicable for the tax, what can be contributed to so you can receive a tax credit. So they included facilities, for example, which didn't exist before. They included native cultural programs, which didn't exist before. They included the Coastal American Partnership, which is very important to the seafood industry, which didn't exist before. So if left to its own devices in 2021, all of those broader beneficiaries are going to go away, and they won't necessarily be allowed. The contributing party won't be able to receive a credit for contributions to those entities. That's the important part.
Thank you.
Thank you. Chad, Senator Mchicky has a question.
Thank you. I'm curious why there's any change in revenue before 21 if you are only changing the narrowing after 21.
And Senator Mchicky, through the chair, are you talking about the fiscal note on?
Mm-hmm.
So if we have the Department of Revenue, that would probably be a.
We do. Ken Alper's in the room. Perhaps he could come forward and answer the question. Welcome, Ken.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And for the record, my name is Ken Alper. I'm the Director of the Tax Division for the Alaska Department of Revenue. In response to Senator Mchicky's question, Mr. Hutchinson explained the bill does two things. The program is scheduled to sunset outright on December 31st of this year. So if no bill were passed, the tax credit would be zero beginning January 2019. Because there have been multiple changes to the statute in the last six or so years, there's a lot of overlapping language and overlapping effective dates. So the narrowing of scope, although it takes place in 2021, would be sort of moot if the underlying program wasn't extended, because there'd be nothing for which the scope would reduce. So I just want to correct something, if you don't mind, Madam Chair, while I'm here. Mr. Hutchinson mentioned a zero fiscal note. The cost of administering the program is zero. We are not anticipating any impact on budgets. But the fiscal note, the bottom portion of the cover page, talks about a reduction in revenue. The reduction in revenue is tied simply to the extension of the program. It's the average of the impact of the tax credit for the last 3 years projected forward for future years. So in other words, this is not a credit that like, for example, the oil and gas credits that are refundable. We're not writing anyone a check. These are credits where the donor of the money to the education organization would take that credit and subtract it from their taxes when they pay their taxes, and we would see it in the form of reduced revenue.
Thank you. Are there any further questions for Mr. Alper, Senator Gardner?
Thank you. So the donors are getting a charitable credit from their federal taxes, and then they also get a reduction on their tax bill to the state. So it's kind of a nice deal for them. And then hopefully for many of them, they also get a workforce that is trained in the areas in which they are interested, that have the facilities or the programs that they want.
Through the chair, Senator Gardner, that is my understanding. I can't speak directly to the federal tax impacts, but it's my expectation that these would be deductible on their federal taxes as well.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Alper, do we know how much money has been contributed and who has received the bulk of the contributions thus far?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, the Department of Revenue is required to submit a report annually to the presiding officers, to the legislature. In February, the 2017 report was sent over earlier this week. I'm sorry I don't have a copy of it with me, but the total, if you look at the second page of the fiscal note, I've identified the amount of credit claimed. The amount of donations leading to that credit are in the neighborhood of $10 or $11 million per year. You'll note that the credit is 50% of the first 100,000 donated and 100% of the next 200,000, or in other words, 250 out of the first 300,000 of a donation, or about 83%. Our experience is a lot of the donations come in at that level, which is where the company gets the maximum benefit for the donation given. So roughly speaking, against $6 million, $7 million in credits, $10 or $11 million in donations.
Thank you. And Senator Meyer, that information is in your packet. There's a chart.
Yeah, I just got it.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so were you able to, let's see, do we know who's getting the bulk of these?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, yes, we do, and we are able to publish that within certain limits of confidentiality. Again, I don't have the report in front of me. Okay. The University of Alaska is the largest recipient. The law was changed a few years ago, provisions added by Senator Bishop that expanded the scope to include vocational education organizations. About 40% of the money is going to those sorts of organizations, and you'll see many of them likely in public testimony talking about how they benefit from the program.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Coghill?
If I might just add to that. In our experience, you can take the fishing industry and the mining industry particularly, and the oil industry probably thirdly, and beneficiaries primarily to the university.
Thank you.
And by the way, Madam Chair, if I may,
Senator Coghill,
you got to remember, it's a tax credit means some reduction to the state, but you get a 50% increase of new money that doesn't get accounted for as a negative, but as a positive to the state generally. So there are some real benefits, new dollars, and certainly benefits to our university.
Thank you, Senator Coghill. As chair of this committee, we've been looking very closely, not at just budget reductions or increments, but at the overall impact. So I appreciate that point. It went through my mind, but I appreciate that you shared it, that the education community benefits. My question is about vocational education courses, and Ken, I'm not sure if your expertise would help with this question, but at Diamond High School in Anchorage, we have funded Project Lead the Way training for teachers to receive national engineering training for courses that prepare young people to become engineers. My question really is, what is considered vocational education? Because these are classes that are taught in the regular, scope. You wouldn't necessarily look at them and consider them vocational education. Dave Roach at Diamond has done a fabulous job in leading this, engineering track at the high school. And so I just want to make sure, and maybe for the public record, that Project Lead the Way programs in our high schools would actually be able to qualify if contributions were made to those types of programs. And also, I know there's a nursing program at Service High School, and there's all sorts of programs throughout our Anchorage School District that train young people to have jobs upon graduation.
So, Madam Chair, let me be honest with you. One of the most awkward parts of my job in administering the tax division is responding to inquiries about the education tax credit. It's not a program that has a pre-approval process. We aren't really in a position to give tax advice, and there is a lot of gray area. In fact, I'd ask the committees as this bill moves, if there are any ambiguities in the qualification sections, please feel free to clear them up, because it is not the cleanest statute out there in the world. But the sort of thing you talk about, per my understanding, should qualify. Programs out of public secondary school should qualify. These sort of job training programs should qualify, but I can't legitimately give tax advice or make a predetermination of any specific donation.
I thought I might be stretching your expertise, but thanks for trying. Senator Coghill?
Madam Chair, that question had also come to me, but you can appreciate my reluctance to taking on a whole code.
I understand, Senator Coghill.
Madam Chair.
Senator Machicki?
Thank you. In the supporting documents, there's something from the Department of Revenue that kind of talks about where the sections of tax program types that go toward the program, and then there's a second page that says secondary vocations and other. Are these organizations, do you know, perhaps for the sponsor, that have received tax benefits, or I'm sorry, contributions that have from the tax benefits?
Madam Chair, and to Senator Machicki, what I plan to do was let some of the public testimony percolate up, because there are those who would advocate, and I think that's probably the better way than looking back at this point. And so letters of support have come in from a variety of different places. I would probably let that speak for that point.
Thank you for the question, Senator Machiki. We do have many individuals online, and perhaps when they provide their public testimony, they might include any comments related to that question.
Thank you.
Any further questions of the sponsor or Mr. Alper? Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate you being here. I'd like to go ahead and open public testimony for Senate Bill 116. First, I'll call on Robert Anders from Alaska Pacific University, calling in from Anchorage.
Hello, this is Robert Anders. I'm the interim president at Alaska Pacific University. And I would like to comment, and I appreciate the ability to give public testimony related to Senate Bill 116. And I'd like to voice that I strongly agree with Senator Coghill's initial comments on the essentialness of the industry being connected with higher education. We have Professor Brad Harris, who's there to testify in person as well on the specifics on how it has impacted APU. But in general, the education tax program is a mutually beneficial partnership with private industry and educational institutions. I think it's critical that education be connected to and interact with industry. Both students and research are products needed in Alaska, and the education tax credit facilitates this connection between it. Education, research, and the workforce development. The resources and partnership generated by the educational tax credit support Alaska's rural and tribal communities in generating community-based research as well as academic curriculum. So I'd strongly encourage the passage of this bill and the extension of the education tax credit. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, Sherry Beretta with Chugach Alaska Corporation.
Thank you, Madam. Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon. I would like to speak in support of this this bill. From Chugach Alaska Corporation's perspective, we have been using the tax credit since 2011 to contribute to mostly university and APU. About a third of our funds go to them, and another third go to vocational and programs such as Kenai Peninsula Borough School to Work, Project Grad, and then funding our cultural camps and education for our villages. But this tool has really allowed us to be able to grow our investment into education. We've recently funded our education endowment to $30 million to be able to generate scholarships of $1 million a year. And so we've been really focused on partnerships and collaboration and trying to create pathways and links, especially to our remote rural villages, to be able to access higher education and getting through school and high school. So this has been an excellent link for the corporation, but on the larger scale, it has also allowed us to work with the university through the ANSEP, School of Business and other departments to integrate Alaska Native history, the contemporary Alaska Native corporations, the other organizations, and really to change the perspective about what Alaska Native corporations can do in partnership with the university and economic opportunities moving forward for the state of Alaska. And switching hats real quick, and I'll just finalize. I got on the Board of Regents at the University of Alaska in 2015, and ever since I got on, the funding has been declining, and it's been a real challenge for the university, cutting and so having tools such as this to be able to collaborate and forge partnerships with businesses is really essential, I think, to the future of the university. So I would highly recommend that this is a benefit to the state and that it continues. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next, I'd like to invite Brad Harris, who's here in the room from Alaska Pacific University. Welcome, Brad. Please feel free to provide your comments on the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and the committee, for hearing my testimony today.
I'd like to speak in support of Senate Bill 116 from the perspective of an educator. So I'm a professor at Alaska Pacific University. I teach fisheries ecology, and I direct a research laboratory that works very closely with commercial fishing industry, state and federal agencies to produce the kind of information that we need to deal with the natural resource challenges that Alaska is facing. And so I'd like to reflect a little bit on some of the comments made already about how this works, but I'd like to primarily leave you with the strong sense that the education tax credit program is working as designed per the statement in the statute. It's providing opportunities for students in Alaska to receive a high-quality education, and as you've heard before, one that's applied directly to the needs of Alaska. So what I do with the education tax credit support that I receive from our partners is, first, it allows me to recruit excellent students. Students come to Alaska from a lot of other places, and we benefit from that. It allows me to recruit students from rural communities that face financial challenges. Once those students are in the university system, it allows me to support them with applied projects, assistantships, and support that helps offset their tuition costs. It allows me to invest in strategically important research areas. So I'm not just an educator, I'm a practitioner. I serve on the Scientific and Statistical Committee of the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council. I see day-to-day what's happening with our natural resources, and it allows me to connect students with areas of applied research that will produce outcomes that are both robust to the changes happening in our ecosystem. I think probably most of you are aware of what's happening with Pacific cod in the Gulf of Alaska, but also the fiscal realities of changing federal budgets and state budgets. It allows me to develop robust synergistic partnerships. Alaska is facing natural resource challenges that really mirror what's happening around the world. And because of these resources, through the tax credit program and the opportunity to work in incredible ecosystems like the Bering Sea, we find partners attracted to us from universities around the world. I have a faculty from Cornell University and Northeastern University, faculty researchers at the Smithsonian, who are working with Alaska students on these applied questions, largely facilitated by the education tax credit. And finally, we're expanding our internal research capacity. The ability for our students to work with these world-class researchers acquires skills or brings them skills and abilities, and those abilities map through to the careers that these students end up taking. So if you'll notice in your packet, you have a letter from me where I outline my perspective as a professor. And in the back is an attachment that just shows an example, one small field in fisheries and natural resources. And for a relatively short period of time, it outlines the students, what communities they came from, and what jobs they have now. And you'll see there's a wide range of outcomes within the state where these students who are receiving the support do exactly what you've heard described. They end up working for Alaska state agencies, federal agencies, consulting companies, universities, and they're providing benefit back to the state. So finally, I urge you to continue this program and to recognize in the uncertain future, both in terms of our budgets and our ecosystem, that this really provides a level of stability that's, we might not have known this when this went in place, but it's now become a critical part of our future. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Brad, for your testimony and also for the letter. So is there anyone else here in Juneau who wishes to testify on the bill? Senator Stevens?
What if I ask a question, Brad?
Oh, of course.
Thank you, Professor, for your comments. How is this marketed? I don't know if the state is doing it. Are you actually approaching industry and saying you could use tax credits and give money to APU? And how does that work, actually?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, that's a great question. Well, as a former professor, you know, we do whatever we need to do, we have to do to see our research programs evolve. And so it's a bit of both. Sometimes the industries approach my research team and say, we've got this really burning challenge. We're trying to figure out how to proceed. And then we talk about various funding mechanisms. And as usual, we diversify. We apply to the North Pacific Research Board. We seek other funds. And then we talk about ways perhaps we could leverage the tax credit program.
That's good to hear, and you see how it started off slow but really grow as time passes. Thank you, Professor.
Thank you very much. I'd like to thank Susan Foley, the president of the University of Alaska Foundation, who's been online this whole time. If there are questions for her, she's available. Okay, seeing none. Thank you, Susan. And also Doug Walrath from the Northwestern Alaska Career and Technical Center is online, calling in from Nome if there are any questions of committee members. Okay, seeing none, thank you very much, Doug, for showing your support by being online. Is there anyone else online that wishes to testify on Senate Bill 116? Okay, seeing none, public testimony is closed. Senator Meyer?
Are you ready for a motion?
I am.
Okay. Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I move that we move Senate Bill 116 with the attached fiscal notes from committee with the attached recommendations.
Is there any objection to moving Senate Bill 116 from committee? Okay, seeing none, so moved, and we'll take a brief at ease. Welcome back to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee, the Senate's Committee on the Economy. And next we have a bill introduced by Representative Tuck. Welcome.
Thank you.
House Bill 126 related to organized militia and workers' compensation. I appreciate you bringing this forward and welcome your staff, Kendra, to explain the bill to the committee.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. Thanks for hearing House Bill 126. For the record, I am Representative Chris Tuck. Serving District 23, South Central Anchorage. This is an act relating to workers' compensation benefits for members of the organized militia. The Alaska State Legislature and Department of Military and Veterans Affairs have been working together to modernize our outdated 1955 Alaska Military Code by providing statutory changes that will better serve our Alaska organized militia. This bill, House Bill 126, would expand workers' compensation coverage to the organized militia while they're participating in training exercises. Currently, Alaska statutes already provide workers' compensation coverage during active state service, however, not during any type of training. By expanding this protection, we could potentially provide a fiscally significant coverage and save the state money in the future. So this issue came to light when a member of the Alaska State Defense Force suffered an injury during a training exercise that led to his inability to go to work. Since workers' compensation was not available, this injury ultimately cost the state twice the amount of the entire annual budget of the Alaska State Defense Force. So the Risk Management Division of the Alaska Department of Administration estimates that there would be little to no additional cost to cover the Alaska State Defense Force members under existing state workers' compensation policies. And basically, this is what this bill does, is just to add them into our workers' compensation. And so as we face tight fiscal times, we've got to be very conscious of what can happen to our state budget. And it's important that we take steps now to making sure that we don't unintentionally increase any costs.
Thank you.
And with me, joining me, is my Chief of Staff, Kendra Closter.
Welcome, Kendra.
Thank you.
Are there comments or questions from committee members? Senator Stevens.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. So are we talking about National Guard? Is that who else would be involved in active militia?
So currently it's mostly Alaska State Defense Force. The National Guard is covered, and they really don't do any training that needs to be necessarily covered by the state of Alaska.
Could you define what Alaska State Defense Force is?
Yeah, Alaska State Defense Force is a group of militia, about 111 members, that is under the authority of the Adjutant General, that can be called into for emergency disasters, for safety of the community, and so on and so forth, not necessarily being called in by the President.
Senator Stevens, any follow-up questions?
No, thank you.
Well, yes, I do have, if Senator you don't Stevens. Mind. could you help me understand the, maybe you can't explain too much about the you said it cost us twice the amount. Can you give a little more detail on that?
Kendra Kloster, staff to Representative Chris Tuck. And so when we're talking here, we're looking at the Alaska State Defense Force, who is actually a voluntary organization. So they kind of supplement our National Guard. So I just wanted to make that clear that this is a voluntary organization. We have a number of members that we've been recruiting more. So we use the State Defense Force in times, for example, like if we have an earthquake that were going to happen, a lot of our National Guard may be taking care of their own families. So the State Defense Force is really a backup for the state. So they are a group of voluntary individuals. And we do have Colonel James here, I believe, hopefully he's in the audience, who's with the Alaska State Defense Force, and then also Deputy Commissioner Bob Dole that is on the line. So.
And could you follow up on the question of the cost us twice as much as having workers' comp?
So, and sorry, to follow up on that question, Senator Stevens through the chair. When the individual had hurt himself, what it ended up going into was a settlement. And so we ended up settling that, so it didn't go through a court procedure, but we did have to pay basically twice the times of what it would have cost to go on the workers' compensation. And so the State Defense Force budget, I'll defer essentially what that those costs may be, but it's for, like I say, they're a voluntary organization, but there may be some costs that are needed that Bob Dole online could probably elaborate more on.
Senator Stevens, would you like to have Bob Dole reply to that?
Yes, please, Madam Chair.
Mr. Dole?
Good afternoon. For the record, Deputy Commissioner Bob Dole, State of Alaska, Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. Senator Stevens, in answer to your question of why it is substantially more, the when litigation ensues, as opposed to a workers' comp proceeding, plaintiff who is suing basically in court can get damages or get money for things they cannot get in a workers' comp proceeding. For instance, basically a workers' comp action, the individual gets made whole for their wage loss, and that's it. In a court action, they also get pain and suffering. They get a much higher rate of attorney's fees. They get pre- and post-judgment interest. When you start adding all those things on, the cost just spikes exponentially, and you lose kind of that that lower level of damages you end up paying out for a workers' comp action, which is why the Division of Risk Management assigned a found a zero fiscal note. We've only had one claim, so we don't have enough of the database, but they determined this action would not raise our workers' comp premium to Division of Risk Management. And although there's few actions, when you do have actions, workers' comp is a cheaper way to pay for it than going to litigation.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner.
Senator Machicki.
Thank you, Mr. Dole. Has there been any other incidents? And I understand, of course, I could make a joke about indeterminate fiscal notes, but I won't right now. But has there been any other cases that you can bring to our attention without mentioning names, of course? Has there been additional exposure?
For the record, Deputy Commissioner Dole, through the chair, in answer to Senator Machicki's question, first I'd like to reinforce that for guardsmen injured in the course of training, they have a federal remedy equivalent to workers' comp. So although we have had those with some frequency over the years, there has been no other one. This is the only reportable Alaska State Defense Force injury that we're aware of that resulted in a claim. We would note, however, that up until recently, we only had about 50 members of the Alaska State Defense Force actively participating. In the last 2 years, that has grown to closer to 120, and interest continues to surge. So, if you will, there's increased opportunity or exposure for something to happen as we have more folks training for disaster preparedness.
One more follow-up.
Senator Machicki.
And that, again, is approximately, less than 100 members, 2 days a month for training as well as 4 days a year for exercise. Is that the case?
Through the chair, this is Deputy Commissioner Dole. That's the case generally, yes, unless they're called up for actual disaster response, in which case they're under state active duty and paid and under workers' comp that way as a state employee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Are there any further questions? Senator Meyer?
Thank you. Thank you, Deputy Commissioner Dole. How often have these folks been called up to active duty?
Through the chair, this is Deputy Commissioner Dole. Senator Meyer, up until this year, it was just small groups of probably one or two doing things like shelter relief management during the wildland fires. This year, a team was called up for state active duty and deployed to Puerto Rico to provide communications support after the communications infrastructure is wiped off the island by the hurricane. In that case, they were paid by the state as under state active duty. They were considered state employees had anything happened to them. However, we're being 100% reimbursed by FEMA for their wages and benefits we paid.
Okay, I appreciate that. And Deputy Commissioner, you did say it's closer to 120 members now?
Through the chair, this is Deputy Commissioner Dole. Senator Meyer, Colonel James is in the room. I understood we were closer to 120 than 111, but I'm confident it's over 110. I'll say that for sure.
Okay. Well, I only mention that because the fiscal note says 76. So,
through the chair, this is Deputy Commissioner Dole. We've been growing. This bill initiated last year. We've been in a growth spurt since then.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any further questions of committee members? Okay. Thank you very much. We'll go ahead and open public testimony. Is there anyone here in Juneau who would like to testify? Colonel James, if you're interested or not.
We're here.
Is there anyone online who wishes to testify on the bill? Okay, seeing none, a public testimony for House Bill 126 is now closed, and I will look to the will of the committee. Senator Machicki?
Madam Chair, I'm willing to move this bill. If I can't think of any reason to hold it, I see a very minimal amount of risk, and I actually think it's a bill that reduces risk to the state overall. So I'm comfortable if that's your intent today.
It is, and I've met with General Hummel, and I'm very supportive of the legislation. So, Senator Meyer?
Okay, Madam Chair, I move that the committee at CS for House Bill 126, Military and Veterans Affairs, be moved from committee with attached fiscal notes and committee recommendations.
Is there any objection to moving House Bill 126 from committee? Okay, seeing none, so moved. Thank you, Representative Tuck.
And thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee members.
Of course. We'll take a brief at ease. Back to Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. Next on our agenda is Senate Joint Resolution 12, Congress Reversed FCC on Net Neutrality. We have the resolution sponsor, Senator Wilikowski, and his staff. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Bill Wilikowski. I'm state senator representing East Anchorage and Jaybird. I'm here with Nate Graham, who's staff in my office. Thank you for hearing this resolution, and thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Gardner, for co-sponsoring this resolution as well. Just a little background on net neutrality. On December 14th, 2017, the Federal Communications Commission adopted by a 3-2 vote an order to reverse the regulations that established the federal government's broadband policy of net neutrality. Net neutrality means everyone has equal and open access to everything on the Internet. It means telecommunication companies or Internet service providers, also known as ISPs like AT&T, Verizon, and Comcast, cannot charge you for using specific websites. Without net neutrality, the cable companies can charge you to access various websites, download music, download videos, access your email, access news sites. They can create fast lanes for certain websites, slow lanes, throttle back speeds for others. They can charge you fees for emails, YouTube, Google searches. This is one of the reasons that Facebook, Google, Amazon, Netflix, and many others oppose the recent FCC action. There are smaller sites that have very little negotiating power that are also very concerned about this action by the FCC, because their concern is that they can't afford to necessarily pay the higher fees that will be charged, and so they'll be throttled back in favor of larger companies that can afford to pay these higher fees. There's concern that this will stifle startups, innovation, entrepreneurship, and that's the reason that many small companies and entrepreneurs do oppose this repeal. Without net neutrality, if an internet service provider does not want you to see a website, they can simply block it or censor it. And I hear people say, well, that'll never happen. It actually has happened. And we have a couple examples. For instance, Verizon once blocked text messages from a pro-choice advocacy group, NARAL, because they deemed them to be too controversial, as reported in the New York Times. By contrast, religious groups also oppose this for the very same reason. In fact, Pat Roberts Christian Coalition states on their website, quote, if net neutrality dies, the internet as we know it today will cease to exist. This repeal is a real definite threat to free speech. It is perhaps the gravest threat we face today to our free speech rights. The arguments for repealing net neutrality, we believe, don't have very much merit at all. People say internet service providers simply won't slow down speeds. They just won't do that. But they've already done it in the past. For example, when Netflix was negotiating with Comcast, Comcast cut Netflix speeds gradually, ultimately down by 24% until Netflix agreed to pay more. Some say that, well, if one provider abuses the system, then competition will save us. But 96% of the United States population has access to at most two wireline providers, and half of all households in America have no choice at all. And that situation is very similar to what we see here in Alaska, where we have very limited options and expensive options already. Some say this will hurt investment, but capital investment actually increased after the original net neutrality regulations were passed several years ago. Some say there will be transparency. The Federal Trade Commission, FTC, will oversee the internet. But all the FTC will look out for is whether the companies tell you about how they're censoring, how they're blocking, and how they're throttling, not actually stopping them from throttling, blocking, or censoring. Not only is the reversal of net neutrality bad for consumers, but the public comment was very flawed. For example, of the 21 million comments that were received on this regulation, up to 2 million were linked to stolen identities. Nearly 500,000 were likely generated from Russian electronic mail addresses. 94% were apparently submitted multiple times. 57% came from duplicate or temporary addresses. In 9 separate occurrences, 75,000 identical or similar comments were posted at the exact same second. This is not political. This is not a Republican, not a Democratic issue. In fact, there has been at least multiple polls on this. One very well-known one was at the University of Maryland School of Public Policy, where they asked in December and found that 83% of Americans opposed the FCC action, including 75% of Republicans and 89% of Democrats. Fortunately, there is something that we can do to fix this, and I know this body, we see a lot of resolutions, and we wonder about how effective they are. Well, the Congressional Review Act grants Congress the authority to overturn this order with a simple majority vote. There are already 50 votes in the United States Senate. We only need one more vote. And our congressional delegation has not indicated how they'll vote on this, but they have not indicated that they would support overturning this. So if we got one of our senators to do this, we could pass this through the United States Senate. I think passing this would be an important message to Alaskans. We have provided numerous emails that we've received, actually through representing the House, who's sponsoring similar legislation, has received regarding net neutrality. My staff, Nate, will have a very brief overview. It'll be 5 minutes or less, if we could, Madam Chair. And then I know we're getting a little close to time. So I'll stop right there, and I can answer questions, or we can have Nate just jump right in and give his quick presentation.
Senator Wilikowski, thank you. I just have one question. On page 3, lines 6 through 9, you mentioned some companies, Apple, Microsoft, Amazon, Netflix, and Facebook, oppose the FCC's net neutrality order. I was just curious where, I mean, I'm sure there's documentation of that opposition, and where did you find that?
Madam Chair, I'm going to turn to my staff who's spent a lot of time on this. We can certainly get you that. There is, I think if you go online and just do some research on it, but if you've got that, if you could point that out, Nate, please state your name for the record.
Thank you.
For the record, Nate Graham, staff to Senator Wilikowski. So the article that we found with tech companies that were opposing net neutrality was in a Business Insider article, and I believe it's in the supporting documents as well.
Okay, thank you for that. Does the committee wish for Nate to go through the sectional, perhaps? No? Okay. Thank you very much. Are there any questions of committee members? Senator Machicki? Okay.
Yeah, I think the case is strong. Madam Chair, thank you. Senator Wilikowski, I think the case is strong, and it, it I know we agree on almost everything, so this is interesting. But I'm not sure that some of the references were necessary. I think the University of Maryland poll was a little bit heavy-handed, but I think it's convincing without some of those items. But I believe this is going right to the floor, and I think
the actually, Senator Machicki goes to State Affairs.
State Affairs. Okay. So I definitely don't want to slow it down here today, Madam Chair. I think your case is strong enough. My fear throughout the process is that Congress does not understand the issue. We've seen a lot of evidence of that. It's not a partisan issue. It's not a free market issue. It's about whether or not you believe the Internet is a utility, which I personally do. So I understand why you added those things, but I appreciate you bringing it forward nonetheless. Thank you.
Senator Stevens.
Madam Chair, thank you. It just seems like, to me, like Alaska would be more impacted than most other states. Could you be more specific about that, Senator?
I think you're absolutely right. I think my understanding is the percentage of people that use the Internet is in Alaska is higher. And particularly in rural Alaskan communities, there's a tremendous reliance on social media, on access to news, on people working through the using the Internet to work. We have telemedicine, for example, which you really don't see in many other places. So I mean, we can certainly provide you with specific examples, but I feel fairly comfortable saying that the Internet is probably used more and more for work, more for play than in Alaska than probably just about any other state.
Thank you, and Madam Chair. I had not thought about telemedicine, but that's a very good point because it's just developing and it has a great future, but this could damage it. So thank you.
Senator Gardner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't have a question, but just a comment. Another reason that Alaska is different is because, as Senator Wilikowski pointed out, is that many places don't have choices. You know, you have one provider. And take it or leave it. So if they slow you down, you're just hosed. The other thing I wanted to point out is one of my staffers looked up his own name on the list of testifiers supporting repealing net or closing down net neutrality and found his own name on 3 comments, even though he hadn't submitted any. 2 of them he agreed with and 1 he did not. So I haven't looked up my own name, but maybe I should do that.
Well, seeing this is the only committee in the legislature with a Facebook page, I think it's fitting that we move this on out. Senator Meyer.
Okay. Madam Chair, I move that we move Senate Joint Resolution number 12 from committee with attached fiscal notes, 0 fiscal notes, and attached committee recommendations from committee.
Excuse me, though. I do believe we did not open or close public testimony. Is there anyone here in Juneau who wishes to testify? Is there anyone online who wishes to testify? Okay, seeing none, public testimony is closed for SJR 12. Senator Meyer.
Okay, try to do better this time. Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I move that we move Senate Joint Resolution number 12 from committee with attached fiscal notes, zero fiscal notes, and committee recommendations.
Is there any objection to moving Senate Joint Resolution 12 from committee? Okay, seeing none, so moved. And thank you, Senator Wilikowski. The meeting is adjourned.